I'm John Krall. As we head into a holiday weekend, there's no better time to discuss the place where many, many Hoosiers and others get to enjoy the outdoors, Indiana's state parks. We'll talk about what the state parks have to offer and the challenges of maintaining them. My guests today are Ginger Murphy, Assistant Director for Stewardship for Indiana State Parks and Reservoirs, Phil Bloom, also with the DNR, and Angie Manuel, an interpretive naturalist at Prophetstown State Park. Please join the conversation by calling 1-866-476-3881, emailing nolimits@wfyi.org, or connecting via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news.
Support for No Limits is provided by WGU Indiana, Indiana's 8th state university. Information about earning a degree from WGU, an accredited online nonprofit university, is available at indiana.wgu.edu.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Indiana's state parks. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. My guests today all have intimate knowledge of the state's parks, starting with Ginger Murphy, who is Assistant Director for Stewardship for Indiana State Parks and Reservoirs. Ginger, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, John. I am just thrilled to be here. Thanks for the opportunity to be here and be a part of the conversation.
Certainly. We are glad to have you here. Angie Manuel, who is an interpretive naturalist at Prophetstown State Park. Angie, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Good to have you here. And Phil Bloom, who is the communications director for the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. Phil, welcome to the program.
Good to be here, John.
Well, I'm going to start first so that everybody knows all of this. I threw a mouthful of titles here out at people. Could you, Ginger, talk to me a little bit about what the Assistant Director for Stewardship does, what the responsibilities are, and at least how we're defining stewardship in regard to the state's parks and reservoirs?
Certainly. For us in state parks and reservoirs, stewardship is about taking care of the natural and cultural resources and helping people understand the value of those resources. So I work with our staff on natural resources issues, everything from how we manage our deer herds and our deer reductions in parks to prescribed fire, to helping to remove invasive plants. The cultural resources part, we have a lot of historic structures in our parks, all the way from buildings that were built by the Civilian Conservation Corps to homes and residences that were a part of the original Indiana that became state parks, people who gave us land or sold us land, and so that's a part of it. And then we work with volunteers and partners across our system. That's a part of stewardship, too, our friends groups and volunteers. And then finally, our interpreters, who are the people who tell the stories about our parks and do all sorts of great programs. So it's a great role and a great way to be involved in our state park system.
That sounds like a really sweeping set of responsibilities.
It
to
is.
Me. I mean, how large a budget are we talking? How many people do we have involved in that work?
Well, we have four full-time staff who are committed to working with stewardship issues in our system. Besides me, we have a biologist, we have a chief of interpretation and a chief of cultural resources and a volunteer coordinator. And they work with our property managers and our interpreters across the system. So our full-time staff in parks and reservoirs, they have a lot of responsibilities, everything from managing facilities to managing the resources. So it's a big job for each person who works there.
When you talk about sites, how many are we talking about in the state?
We have 24 state parks in Indiana. And then we have 8 reservoir properties. 7 of those are properties that were built, Corps of Engineers lakes that were built, and the property around them we manage. And then there's one reservoir property in southern Indiana, Hardy Lake, that was a state water project. So 32 properties altogether.
That you have to keep track of.
We keep track of about 179,000 acres, about 16.5 million visitors a year.
Oh, boy. Okay. And Angie, I want to also get a real quick description of what an interpretive naturalist does, if you could walk me through that.
Sure. Well, an interpretive naturalist has, you know, a wide-ranging job description, much like Ginger's. You know, we do everything from develop the programs that talk about the natural and cultural history of our park to delivering the programs, which come in the form of campfire programs, nature hikes, day camps for kids and adults. It could be everything from cultural programs, which involve music, to the arts, everything that talks about the natural and cultural history of our park. I'm part of developing those programs. And additionally, the naturalist, the interpretive naturalist, works with volunteers, works with friends groups, works with partners in our community to bring those programs to the visitors in our park every single year.
How do you train to do that kind of work? I mean, what preparation is required?
Certainly your background, your educational background, it has to be first and foremost. There has to be a higher education, but it could be in a number of fields. Could be biology, wildlife sciences, resource management. But we have interpretive naturalists who have backgrounds in education, in history, in archaeology. So your background, your higher education background, could be many things. But the state also does a wonderful job of training interpretive naturalists every single year. Of the 32 properties that Ginger referenced, only about half of those have full-time naturalists, and the other half have seasonal naturalists who really welcome the visitor during the recreation season, the high recreation season. So we
primarily
right now, you got it. But we all get trained once a year so that we all know how to deliver the right message to our visitor.
Phil, in terms of the activity and the stress point, how big a weekend is the Labor Day weekend for the parks?
This is pretty big. There usually, traditionally, historically, has been Memorial Day, 4th of July, and Labor Day weekends are the big three for them. Although if you talk to these folks, they would tell you that their seasons have extended to much earlier in the year and much later in the year than maybe 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Why is that?
Well, I think people are finding that the parks have a lot to do, a lot of activities, and maybe a little quieter time to go camping in October than over one of those big weekends. So that's been a real attraction for our visitors, to come at a quieter time, what would be referred to as the shoulder seasons.
We are talking about Indiana State Parks here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. We're talking about how the season has expanded here, and people are using the parks more often. There's a part of me that also wonders, as we've found more space being developed in the state and fewer sort of wild or quiet places like that. I mean, is it that we have driven people more to the parks to find, you know, what they could find simply by taking a walk in the country? I'll throw that one to either Angie or Ginger, whichever one of you feels like taking it.
Well, I certainly think, John, that we our parks are important places of refuge for people to get outside and enjoy the outdoors. And Indiana has doesn't have a huge amount of public land in terms of the if you look at all the acres in the state and the amount that's public, but certainly our parks provide great places and the reservoirs provide great places for people to get outdoors and enjoy all sorts of outdoor recreation, not just quiet. People love to swim in the pools and have a great time and do all sorts of activities, and we enjoy having them all come and be with us. And I think the season, the expansion of the season has to some extent, it surprised us a little bit. As Phil said, it used to be Memorial Day weekend and 4th of July and Labor Day weekend, and now we say the fourth weekend is the whole month of October because people just love to camp during the month of October.
Well,
it's great weather.
It's a little cooler, and you get
the
leaves
bugs are
changing.
Gone and,
don't have to worry about mosquitoes and all of that. Mm-hmm. That sort of stuff. You said that 16.5 million people annually.
16.5 million people
come through the Indiana State Parks every
every year. That's more than twice the population of the state.
Yeah.
Who are these folks? I mean, have you done demographic breakdowns on who uses the parks the most? And
I think we have a real wide range of visitors across our system. We have both urban and rural parks. So we have folks from the greater metropolitan Indianapolis area who use Fort Harrison and the parks that are in a donut around the metro Indy area. We have parks that are in rural areas where we have a lot of rural folks that come and use them. So families, a lot of families use our parks, a lot of parents with kids or grandparents with kids. One of the best stories I hear and love to hear is people who are making a point of visiting every park with their kids or their grandkids over the course of their lifetime. They're checking them off and visiting every single one and doing activities in the parks together. In the fall, we get a lot of retired folks who are coming to camp and enjoy the parks and visit. Christmas and Thanksgiving, we get family reunions or families that will meet at our state park inns. And just every year, they come back and have their Thanksgiving celebration or their Christmas celebration at our inns. I think we have just a really diverse group of people using it. And one of the things that we're excited about is that we now have mountain bike trails mm-hmm. on several of our properties. Brown County is really internationally known now as a place for mountain biking. The park
Do people come from out of state?
People
for
come
that,
from out of state out of for that. Absolutely. Absolutely. They come and use the park because it's well recognized now. The mileage and the types of trails that are there, the word has spread across the country about those mountain bike trails. And that draws a younger audience, which is exciting for us to see.
I would assume those folks also aren't just your standard recreational mountain bikers. I mean, I a personal aside, and I'll try to keep this short. I remember when I worked at the Indianapolis News years ago when the state was hosting the Pan American Games, I, sort of a hobby, was a competitive triathlete at the time. And I remember the editors got bright idea that it'd be wonderful for me to go down there and ride the course that they were doing for the road bike races and all of that sort of stuff. And even though I was young and in good shape, it almost killed me. I mean, it was just god awful. So when I hear that we're drawing people in here to ride down in the Brown County State Park, ride mountain bikes down there, I think those have got to be some very, very fit people.
Yeah, they don't call them the Hills of Brown for nothing.
No. Which parks are the ones that are most heavily used?
Well, Indiana Dunes, Brown County are the two big ones. I think some of our reservoir properties might even exceed visitation that those two do. But in terms of the parks, those are the big two year in and year out that draw the most visitors, usually at or above a million apiece for those two.
Which reservoir properties, you were saying, draw more attention?
There are actually two or three. Brookville Lake, which is over by the Ohio border, and then Monroe Lake, which is just south of Metro Indy, and then Raccoon State Recreation Area is another one. All three of those have about a little bit over a million visitors a year.
We are talking about Indiana State Parks here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Angie, you serve primarily a specific park, right? Prophetstown?
Correct, Prophetstown State Park.
Who are the people that come there to that park? What sort of questions do they have? What kind of programs do you offer that designed specifically to serve them?
Right. Prophetstown State Park is actually Indiana's newest state park, just being 9 years old, so people are still learning about us. But once they do come to the park, they obviously are interested in
Feel free to tell them where it is.
Sure. It is. Our address is West Lafayette, mm-hmm. near the small town of Battleground, mm-hmm. and that's actually a clue about what our namesake is, which is Prophetstown, the story of the prophet, also Tenskwatawa and his brother, the Tecumseh, the Shawnee Indians who made an encampment there. So it is our namesake. So we do talk about the cultural history of the land and the native people who have lived there for actually thousands of years. But in addition to the cultural history, people really learn about the natural history there, the beautiful prairies, which are found in very few places in Indiana today, the geologic history, the beautiful bluffs and the seeps and springs, and, of course, the Wabash and Tippecanoe River that come together at what is now Prophetstown State Park today. So people enjoy learning about the cultural history there, but also the natural history. And our visitors tend to come there for that. They're looking for a different view. Prophetstown is a prairie park, and so it looks a little different than some of our others. And so people do enjoy the rolling trails as opposed to the hills of Brown County. People come to the park to learn about history and enjoy themselves. There's a lot of things to do there. But you did talk about how our recreation season has changed a little bit. And since we are in West Lafayette, after Labor Day weekend, our visitor base, especially in our campground, changes from your average Hoosier who's coming to camp to the average Purdue home game visitor.
We'll talk about that dynamic after the break. We are talking about Indiana State Parks here on No Limits. I am John Krall. Please stay with us.
No Limits on 90.1 is made possible by your membership and by Katz & Corin PC, a law firm proud to sponsor the WFYI Blue Stage with a live broadcast of The Art of the Matter on 90.1, Saturday, September 7th, supporting both WFYI and the Penrod Society. And by Terry Lee Honda and Avon, offering options in car buying. First-time visits are for fact-finding to enable informed buying decisions with all the information. That's TLC, the Terry Lee Commitment. More at terrylehonda.com. To call into No Limits this afternoon, the toll-free number is 866-476-3881. That's 866-476-3881. Email nolimits@wfyi.org. We're on Facebook and Twitter at WFYI.
I'm Liberty Spikes from the Circle City Derby Girls, and I listen to The Art of the Matter on 90.1.
Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Indiana State Parks. My guests are Ginger Murphy, who is the assistant director for stewardship for Indiana State Parks and Reservoirs, Angie Manuel, who's an interpretive naturalist at Prophetstown State Park, and Phil Bloom, who's the communications director for the DNR. Roger, welcome to the program.
I'm here.
What's on your mind?
A serious, serious problem. Up at the Indiana Dunes National Park, as I assure the people that you have there know, there was a kid that was almost killed. And they haven't figured out exactly why, but he fell in a hole in the dunes. Now, right next door is these folks, Indiana Dunes State Park. I'm wondering what they are doing to protect people from falling in a hole in the dunes. That's my question.
Thanks very much. Thanks very much for the call, Roger. Well, Ginger, I'll let you take that one.
Well, Roger, that's a very good question. And as you noted, the accident actually happened at the National Park Service site, Indiana Dunes National Lakeshore, but we are right next door. And so, first of all, it's incredible that this young man is doing so well. It's just been great to see on the news how successfully he's recovered, and the partnership that all the folks, the work that all the folks did to get to him and get him to the hospital as quickly as possible. So that's a really great thing, and was a team effort. The National Lakeshore and the State Park are side by side, located side by side. There's pockets of communities and city and urban land in between the State Park and the National Lakeshore, but the beaches are pretty much contiguous. And it sounds like what I know, that there was a tree that had decayed that was buried in the sand, and that happens quite often. Mm-hmm. Because the sand blows up there. It blows off, the wind coming off the lake blows the sand, and the dunes are constantly moving. It's a fairly regular occurrence there. It's an interesting phenomenon to watch. So it sounds like a tree had been buried and maybe had decayed, and so there was a cavity there. We have done a search along the state. We have checked the state park dunes and have been looking and watching carefully on the dunes. Our staff have been out and checked the sand dunes for evidence of anything like that, where there's a portion of a tree sticking up that may be partially buried. So we've had our staff look at the trails, and they've been up and down the dunes where people access it as well, just to try and make sure we don't have something like that happen at the state park as well.
What are the safety and security issues involved in a state park? I imagine they would vary from property to property, as you call them. I mean, the reservoir, you obviously worry more about drowning than you would at some place where there's no water. But what are the big challenges, Ginger?
Well, if you think about our parks on a weekend in particular, it really becomes like a small city. Each one of them is like a small city. You have a campground full of people who are close together in campsites and are in touch with one another. You have people out using trails like you would have people using the roads in a city. You have people using the facilities. And so it can be busy. Mostly people are there because they want to be there, and so they're having a good time, and they work together in the cooperative. But our property managers and our security staff are there to help keep people safe and secure. One of the reasons Indiana has controlled gate access, has entrance gates, much of the time is that helps to provide that additional level of security. When you come in, you pay your gate fee, and you can't come in unless you pay your gate fee during the busy recreation seasons. And then we have a great relationship with our Indiana conservation officers, who are our law enforcement officials who are in our campgrounds, out on the water at the reservoirs, watching for people who've had a little too much to drink or not observing the fishing rules, or who are not observing the hunting rules on reservoirs during hunting season. So between our security officers and our conservation officers and our property staff, we work very hard at keeping people safe and secure.
We've gotten, actually, you'd mentioned the gate fees. We've gotten an email question from a listener, and if you would like to send an email to us, you can do so by sending it to nolimits@wfyi.org. This is from a listener named Colleen, who says, "My husband and I have visited a number of state parks in other states. I don't believe that we have ever paid an admission fee. I've always thought that when people from other states visit our parks, they may be put off by our fees. I'm not naive. I realize that state parks must be sustained financially. How do other states do this? And has Indiana ever considered funding state parks without admission fees?" Who wants that one?
Well, I can take that
Ginger,
one. And
okay.
Phil, if Phil wants to add, or yeah, Angie please. Wants to add something. It's actually interesting, Colleen. We have almost a 100-year history in Indiana of having a user fee. Our founder in 1916 was Colonel Richard Lieber, and one of the principles Lieber looked at was he felt pretty strongly, he looked at other park systems that were forming and believed that it was important to have users pay a small fee so that they would feel connected to the park and feel like they were helping to support it and pay for it. And so that is a philosophy that's been a part of our system since 1916. We certainly do everything we can to keep those fees as low as we can in our parks across the system. It covers about 70% of our operating costs. The user fees and camping fees cover about 70% of our operating costs. The other 30% comes from the general tax, the general fund. So we are about 70% self-funded by the fees that user provide. Most other states are funded by general fund tax dollars or some other sort of tax that they have operating in their states. That's the difference between us and a lot of the surrounding states.
Yeah, Phil.
I think those states that have, you can look at a number of other states where they are funded solely by their general tax dollars, where in the economic downturn that we've recently experienced, it stressed the ability for government agencies to pour money into those state parks. And some places they've closed them as a result of tight budgets.
We are talking about Indiana state parks here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. On that, that 70%, you'd mentioned that there are certain parks that are more heavily used than others. You know, are there... I'm going to ask, I guess, a fairly crass question. Are there certain parks that carry the rest of the system in that regard? Ginger?
There are certainly parks that generate more in user fees than others. But we also know that that some of those parks that don't generate quite as much money are important for the users that visit those and also important in our system. For example, Shade State Park is not a park that has quite as many, well, nearly as many users as some place like Turkey Run, which is right next door. But Shades provides a quiet, a little quieter place with access to those incredible geologic formations that are over at Turkey Run as well. So those are important. So yeah, there are some parks that generate more user fees, more revenue that help to carry the others and help to balance things out.
What's the one that generates the most revenue in the state?
Raccoon State Recreation Area generates a significant amount of revenue. Indiana Dunes, significant amount of revenue. Those are probably two of the highest. There are three or four others that are pretty far up there, too, but those are probably two of the highest.
And how does your use, and I'm going to come back to Angie here in a minute because I am curious to hear about the whole Purdue University tailgating and state park thing, but in terms of, we've been through a period of considerable economic volatility. What does that do to park usage? Does it go up when the economy's, you know, in a downturn so that people can have cheaper vacations, or, you know, is there any sort of relationship between the two?
I think so, yeah. We have, when people are, when gas prices are up and it's harder to travel long distances, we have people who stay close to home and stay here in Indiana and use our parks. We have people who use parks every year, though probably the factors that affect us more than anything are the weather. When it's really, really hot for a long period of time, like we had last summer, when we have campfire bans like we did last summer in some locations, a campfire is so much of being a part of a camping experience that affects people's willingness to go camp. We had some folks who decided not to come last year because of the heat.
Well, and it could also be it's not nearly as much as much fun to sleep in a sleeping bag
when you're sweating.
When you could swim in your own sweat, basically.
Yeah. And then when we have a lot of rainfall, our reservoirs are flood control reservoirs. So that's one of the primary purposes they're there, and that takes priority over recreation. And so we've had several years in the last 10 where we've had some of our reservoirs that have had no beach for the better part of the summer because of that situation. So that affects our attendance too. But I think certainly the economic situation did draw people in. It was close to home, an inexpensive way to get outdoors and just do family recreation together. And it's been a pinch for us. We've had to stretch dollars just like families do, but we've been able to keep all of our parks open and all of our reservoirs open and keep them available for people to use, which we're very happy about.
We are talking about Indiana State Parks here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Angie, okay, now let's talk about how the Purdue football season alters the way Prophetstown. And then from there, I want to talk about whether there are other factors that affect usage at other parks in the state. But Angie, let's talk about the Purdue factor at Prophetstown first.
Yeah. Well, you know, like was mentioned, yes, Labor Day does tend to be the big, you know, final camping weekend, but it's traditionally, in the last few years, we've seen it extend through the fall season. But what we've seen is that at Prophetstown State Park, that season from September to November has been booked with Purdue fans or other fans. Mm-hmm. Hopefully we don't get into a rivalry in the campground, but you see a lot of Purdue flags flying. We occasionally see Chicago Blackhawks flags flying. So a lot of people do come to the area for sporting events, but specifically it is the Purdue folks, because they have their football season schedule in front of them for the next 2 months. They reserve their campsite for every home game. And like I said, the Purdue flags are flying in the campground.
How much is it to reserve a campsite? How much is that? Or is there?
There certainly is a fee. Mm-hmm. We have both electric sites and full hookup sites, and those will have different prices because they have different amenities. If I'm not mistaken, on a weekend, a full hookup site is, and I see Phil's
looking it
Phil
up.
Is rumbling through.
Phil's looking.
Is it $26?
Yeah.
Yes.
$26 for
Sunday
a weekend.
Yeah.
$26 for a weekend. That's full hookup.
Okay.
And I believe it's $19 for an electric.
And do you define a weekend, obviously, as from Friday night through Sunday night or
actually,
Friday
actually
night?
At state parks, weekend constitutes a Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night. That is what weekend constitutes for State Park and Reservoir.
So they're expected to leave on Sunday, though.
They do tend to head out on a Sunday afternoon.
Okay. And does the, you know, in terms of the way the park, I mean, does it get louder then during that time when they're there? I mean, or is it just they're looking for an inexpensive place to stay, and then they use the park as they would otherwise?
Exactly. All of those things are true. It is a place where you see multiple families or multiple friends who want campsites next to each other. It is an easy place to have accommodations for the weekend. And, yeah, occasionally they come back from the game, and they're still pretty riled up based on whether it was a winning game or a losing game. Both scenarios happen. But rarely do things get out of hand. They usually just bring the excitement back to the campground with them.
We are talking about Indiana State Parks here on No Limits. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. David, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, and I've been a lifelong resident of Indiana, and I visited quite a few of the parks. But the question I have is not always one of the most popular ones. I'm an avid hunter in the state of Indiana and a staunch environmentalist. How do biologists and DNR determine when you have a deer herd reduction in the state parks? Is it strictly by head count? Or I was always kind of fascinated how you determine that and what year you do it.
Thanks very much for the call. It's a great question, David.
It is a great question, David. When we first started doing the deer reductions, and in fact, this will be the 20th anniversary of the first deer reduction. The first one was at Brown County in, I believe, 1993. When we first started doing the deer reductions, we did several things to help
us. I'm thinking here, for the non-hunters and others, we probably ought to explain what a deer reduction is. It's not a diet. it's a different sort of experience.
That's a very good point. Thanks,
yeah,
John.
Yeah, sure.
We, in our state parks, which are not properties that are typically hunted, we do allow hunting on our reservoir properties, but not typically in our state parks, and that's legislated. We realized in the late 80s that we were really having an overabundance of deer. And the way we recognized that was not necessarily by just seeing deer, although we did have that happen. We saw the impact that it was having on wildflowers and low-growing plants and shrubs in our parks, and it was a tremendous impact. For example, at Brown County, we saw yellow lady slippers, orchids completely disappear from the park. That's a good example. So there were a number of folks who worked very hard in the late 80s and early 90s to develop a process. They looked at all sorts of alternatives to be able to begin to control the deer populations in our state parks. And it was a tough challenge to figure a good way to do it. And we do that now through regulated hunts, allowing a certain number of people into parks each year to harvest deer. So we determined the number of hunters, not necessarily the number of deer. When we first started, we were looking at the recovery of the plants. We have always looked at the number of hunters that are using the park and the number of deer that are taken and look at a ratio. And that is one of our primary ways of determining whether we've had success. We also look at plant recovery. Those are the two big things that help us decide each year whether we're going to allow a reduction in a park or hold off for another year.
So is it the plants, the basically if those are disappearing, you know you have too many deer? Or are there other factors? I mean, is there some sort of, for lack of a better term, census or accounting of the number of
deer? We don't typically count the deer. Deer are a part of the system. They're not the only piece in the system, so it's not so much about individual deer as it is about the impact that they have on the habitat. So we are looking at plants. We are looking at loss of significant wildflowers. We're looking at browse lines that show up along trees where the deer can no longer find low-growing plants, so they're reaching up and creating a browse line, sort of like you might see in a field with a bunch of cows along a woodlot where they're reaching up and clipping off the tree branches at a certain height. So it is really more about the plants than it is about identifying the number of deer on a property.
So what are what are the triggers for a decision like this to say in a certain park we have a problem and we need to do a hunt here?
Surveys of plant species. We have done in the past plant lines where we do survey lines and look at specific types of wildflowers. There are some kinds of plants that are like candy to deer. It's like a Milky Way to a deer. So we've looked for those and identified whether those plants are available in the system or are surviving in the system. That's one of the ways we look at it. And again, we look at those browse lines. We also did exclosures for a period of time early on where we would put up 6-7 foot high fences to keep the deer out. Mm-hmm. So we would be able to look at the areas inside the exclosures and the areas outside the exclosures, and you could see the damage outside.
We are talking about Indiana State Parks here on No Limits. My guests are Ginger Murphy, Angie Manuel, and Phil Bloom. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, executive editor of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today about Indiana State Parks. My guests are Ginger Murphy, who is the assistant director for stewardship for Indiana State Parks and Reservoirs, Angie Manuel, who's an interpretive naturalist at Prophetstown State Park, and Phil Bloom, who's the communications director with the Indiana Department of Natural Resources. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. I'm going to start. Phil, what are the biggest challenges in preserving our state parks and reservoirs?
Well, I think probably to begin with, you've got natural settings that people want to go and see, and we want them to come and see that. We want people to come and appreciate the natural resources, the cultural resources, and so on. But you also have to find a balance there, and a concern is always, are they being overused? How do we mitigate those circumstances? So, and then there's always budgetary challenges, and we work with what we're given in terms of the budgets and staffing levels come from that, and what you can do in the parks in terms of development. It all comes together, and I think we do a pretty good job of that and have been doing a pretty good job of that for, as Ginger said, close to 100 years. 2016 will be the 100th anniversary of our state park system, and in 1916, the first state park was presented to the citizens of Indiana as a gift, celebrating the first 100 years of Indiana statehood.
The centennial. So you guys have as the state celebrates its bicentennial, you're going to be celebrating your centennial.
Right.
Let me ask you a question. Since with the funds, where does the bulk of the money go? I mean, what's the most expensive thing about maintaining the state park system? I mean, obviously, I'm assuming personnel are a fair bit, but
yes, the biggest chunk of it is the people. Everything from people who are working our gates and greeting people and answering questions, to the people who are cleaning restrooms and mowing the grass, to our property managers who are making decisions about how the property is going to be managed, our interpretive staff who are the hospitality folks at our property and the telling the stories about the significant resources. So that's where the biggest chunk of the operating dollars goes. Of course, we have to maintain facilities. We have about 2,000 buildings in our parks and reservoirs altogether. We have cabins. We have about 131 cabins that we maintain, something like 17,000 picnic tables in our system if you want to get a feel for numbers.
That's a large family reunion, right?
That's a lot of families, 7,400 campsites, so a lot of campsites, about 75 boat ramps and 17 marinas. So lots of facilities that have to be maintained, picnic shelters that have to be maintained. So personnel and then making sure the facilities are in good shape for people to use are probably the two biggest costs that we have.
Yeah, Phil.
I think if you go property to property, too, you'd be amazed at some of the creativity that different property managers come up with to stretch those dollars that they have available to them for maintenance. A couple of years ago, as an example, we had the Young Hoosier Conservation Corps program. These were young people who came in, were paid a wage, and they did all sorts of work. And up at Pokagon State Park, one of my favorites up in my backyard, they were able to acquire, by searching the park and picking up lots of glacial stone, which is natural to that property. And then they were able to use that to build some erosion barriers along the lake shore and in other parts of the park. If they'd gone off and attempted to buy that stone, it would have cost them a fortune. But they and then at Brown County, same time, they had some issues with one of the old shelters. The property manager was able to go to some of the local limestone areas and get some scrap material that if you went down there and looked at that now, you wouldn't know that it was discards basically from the limestone pits that they were used, but it looks like it belongs there.
What's the most expensive park or property to maintain in the state, the one that costs the most?
Boy, I don't know that I don't have a specific answer to that. Certainly our properties that have a lot of facilities. McCormick's Creek has a lot of historic structures and facilities, a lot of buildings that were built by the Civilian Conservation Corps. Mm-hmm. So in terms of looking at the age of buildings, that would be one thing to look at. It's the age of buildings, the number of buildings, the number of miles of roads that are there. We have great support from NDOT on road management, but just infrastructure, things that you don't see, the water lines and the electric lines and all those things that are buried, those are probably the two things to look at. But in terms of maintenance, I don't think I have a specific number for that.
And before we leave the subject, you do have this 100-year anniversary, a centennial coming up. Are there specific plans to celebrate that milestone, or is it going to be folded into the state's bicentennial celebration?
Well, I think it will be both. Mm-hmm. We are already doing some wonderful things in preparation for that. We have our Division of Communications, which Phil is in charge of, is producing booklets for each property that describe the 100 years of each property or the length of time each property's been there. So we call them our centennial booklets, and those are available for people to pick up. By 2016, we'll have one for every property, so it'll be a complete set. We are already talking about plans in 2016 to have a day where we roll back the entrance price to what it was in 1916, which I think was 10 cents a day.
And oh, boy.
We will do birthday parties, and so we already have some things that are happening to prepare for that, and we will be doing some other things, and we're working in conjunction with the new Bicentennial Commission. We're excited that they're in place.
We are talking about Indiana's parks, state parks. You can join the conversation by calling us at 1-866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org, or you can connect with us via Facebook or Twitter at WFYI. Cheryl, welcome to the program.
Are you asking about Carol? Is it me?
Oh, I had been told Cheryl. If it's Carol.
Hi. I have fond memories of going to the parks when I was a child, and a lot of the evening programs and the nature walks would go on with a ranger or someone from the park. And I know now when we go to the parks, you know, I go and look up somewhere, I find a sign-up sheet or a paper telling what the plans are for the weekend. But is there a way of finding out what each state park is doing each weekend and what the topics are, like looking at stars or history or different topics they may be speaking of?
Absolutely. Carol, I'm glad you asked that question. We have you can very easily get to our website, and there is a page that lists all the activities for each individual park or reservoir. If you go to interpretiveservices.in.gov, that will tell you everything that's happening. And there's a great special events calendar that talks about a lot of the special weekends that we're doing. And there are a lot of those coming up in September and October. But interpretiveservices.in.gov is a great place to go. Angie has lots of great new programs at Prophetstown.
Is there a website specifically for Prophetstown where people can find out what's going on?
Well, the IN.gov, the Indiana DNR website under State Parks and Reservoirs, is where you'll find all the interpretive schedules. And if you click specifically on Prophetstown State Park, you'll get ours. If you click on Brown Counties, you'll get theirs. But many of our state parks and reservoirs also have a Facebook page. You can find that information there.
Does Prophetstown have a Facebook?
They do. You can also
feel free to give them the URL here.
Yeah. But there are also opportunities on some of our state parks websites for you to sign up for an email, maybe once a month email distribution, and that program schedule will come right to your email account. So there are many different ways to get our program schedule, either the Indiana DNR website, possibly a Facebook page, and possibly an email right into your own box.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Ben, who says, "Hello, I've been listening to your program about Indiana State Parks. Have you ever considered utilizing an Indiana license plate that could also double as the entrance gate fee? I think this would generate some additional revenue for the park system, as well as provide some utility for the purchaser. I'd happily pay extra for this. I always seem to misplace my annual pass card, and it would be harder to lose my license plate." He's got a little smiley face on that one. "I see many organizations represented on our Indiana license plates, but I've always wondered why I'm not able to buy one for the state park system." Who wants that one? Phil?
Well, we don't have one, and I'm not sure if any discussion's ever been had regarding a special state park one, but we already have what was the first and remains the most popular license plate. That's the Indiana Heritage Trust environmental plate, which is the blue plate with the sun and the eagle on it. Mm-hmm. That is our license plate for DNR.
How much does that generate for you folks?
It's dwindled as there have been more plates. It's dwindled.
You kind of owned that whole market for a while.
For a while, it was ours. And I don't know what the recent figures are, but I think it's around $400,000 a year in revenue. And that money is used to assist all of our divisions with land acquisition and enhancements of their programs.
And we have certainly bought a lot of land over the years with that funding. So all of those folks who've bought those environmental license plates have helped contribute to access to public land for Hoosiers.
We've gotten another email question from a listener. I'm trying to get as many of these in as possible. Does your panel believe the user fees limit access to lower-income citizens, and as a public asset, shouldn't lower-income individuals have an equal right to utilize these facilities, whether it be camping, fishing, hiking, and so forth? Is there a way, if you say, "I simply can't afford to go to a state park," for you to get a waiver of some kind?
Well, one of the things that I've always liked to say about our park entrance fees is that it's very inexpensive. It's $5. You can get a whole carload in. If you bought the season pass for $40, that's roughly half of what you'd pay to get one person into Disney World for a day. Mm-hmm. And you can use ours to go to any of our state parks any day of the year, all year long. And unlike Disney World being a fantasy world, we've got the real thing at our place.
We are talking about Indiana State Parks here on No Limits. Allison, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I wanted to call and say what a good deal the state parks offer visitors in winter. They have this great offer, sleep for two nights, pay for one, and I've decided to make a tradition of going away for a Valentine's Day sleepover at each state park that has an inn. For my 60th birthday, we went down to Clifty Falls and did the wine area down there. Of course, one misses out on a lot of the nature programming, but the parks are gorgeous at that time of year, and it's a very great bargain, and there are lots of friendly people around, despite the fact it's in the middle of the week in winter. So thank you, Indiana State Parks.
Thank you for the call, Allison. Well, that's got to feel good to hear something like that.
It does. Think. It does. And she is right. Our state park inns typically do two nights for one on Monday through Thursday during the winter. And so it's a great time to come out and enjoy the parks and make a two-day experience of it. And we're open all year. I think that's one of the misconceptions that people have is that we're not there in the wintertime. And we don't staff some of our gates at some properties in the wintertime. So there are it's not really feasible financially to staff a gate when you mm-hmm. don't have a large audience. So there are some opportunities for families who may not have a lot of funds to come out and enjoy the parks at a great time of the year. Lots of good things to do in the winter. Go ride the toboggan at Pokagon. Everybody should do that once in their lifetime.
We've gotten a Facebook question from a listener named Chris who says, I heard recently that zebra mussels have made their way to Geist Reservoir. If this is true, what can the public do to prevent further spread of these invasive species?
Well, I'm not familiar with whether or not they've gotten to Geist Reservoir.
Is
certainly,
it something you worry about, though? Well, because they've
zebra mussels have been a factor in our state waterways for quite some time. There's a lot of information out about trying to stop the spread of invasive species, whether it's zebra mussels or emerald ash borers or any number of other things. There is advice that people who boat and move their boat from one lake to another body of water, that they should try to clean it off before they go. Some of that it leads to the movement of zebra mussels from one place to the next. It is a concern, and we have invasive species biologists who work in our Division of Fish and Wildlife and in other divisions who are working to address the spread of all sorts of invasives.
We are talking about Indiana State Parks here on No Limits, and we've gotten an email question, or actually a comment, from a listener named Matt, who says, I wanted to share just how much I appreciate the emphasis on growing mountain biking at certain parks. The Brown County State Park mountain bike trail system is phenomenal. Clearly, Matt, you must be in shape. Fort Harrison has seen growth in their trail system. I think the partnership between the park system and the Hoosier Mountain Biking Association is a great one. Please continue to grow mountain biking to bring new visitors to enjoy a wonderful sport in a fabulous setting. What are, you know, this is something people might not have been aware of beforehand. I think as we get close to the end of the program here, I'd like to ask, and as people are making their plans for this holiday weekend, what's a hidden gem here in the state, a state park that, you know, maybe the numbers aren't as great as some of the other parks, but you think is just a fabulous place that more people ought to go to? Where would you recommend sending them, Ginger, and what would you have them do there?
Boy, I have a couple. I would suggest a visit to Charlestown State Park, which is down in southeastern Indiana. It is one of our younger parks, has a great new campground. There are wonderful hiking trails and just some beautiful scenic views of the Ohio River. There is a brand new bridge it's an old bridge that was in the town of Portersville that has been renovated and crosses what's called 14 Mile Creek to Rose Island, which was an amusement park in the early 1900s. And we're mm-hmm. in the process of interpreting that. In another year, there'll be great exhibits there. It's close to Louisville. It's really easy to get around and get to Charlestown. That'd be one of the places I would suggest. And then take a day trip to Falls of the Ohio State Park. We don't have camping there, but those fossil beds are internationally known. We have people from all over the world who visit Falls of the Ohio State Park to walk those fossil beds and see the exhibits in the Interpretive Center. So those would be two places I would suggest people try.
In about 20 seconds, Phil, give me your hidden gem.
Ginger mentioned it earlier, Shade State Park. It gets overshadowed a lot by Turkey Run. And for anybody who ever gets Backpacker Magazine, they just, in the September issue, they have designated the most scenic view in all 50 states, and Devil's Backbone at Shade State Park is the place in Indiana.
And I'll tell you what, Angie, for you, I'm going to reframe that question. Tell me something not enough people do at Prophetstown State Park if they want to come. What's an activity they ought to do that they don't do enough of?
I think people should hike the trails. We a few months ago we got called an acquired taste in a newspaper article, and that's fine. They can call us an acquired taste, because once you go on that hike, you're going to see beautiful prairie grasses, again, places you can't see in the rest of Indiana, and bluffs and beautiful trails. So go hiking at Prophetstown.
That'll have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests for joining us. Thank all of our listeners, and I hope you all have a wonderful Labor Day holiday. I am John Krall. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Sharon Allseth. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Jeanette Rhodes. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.